Hello, welcome to OS News Podcast number 10 for 24th of May 2009. We actually made double digits. Hooray!
Yeah. Who would have thought that we would ever be able to keep, you know, keep this going for so long? I mean, it's like the 10th Sunday that we've been doing this. It's really pretty impressive, I think. So I'm pretty happy.
That was quite surprising.
Yeah.
And we haven't driven all the readers away from the website.
No, can you imagine? Well, of course, that's probably thanks to the fact that we didn't do a video podcast. That probably helped in that regard. But still, I think it's pretty impressive. I mean, I think we can be slightly proud of ourselves. I mean, runners aren't like screaming or running away or you know, getting torches and pitchforks out. So we're probably doing something right here, which is pretty good. Yeah.
It's been a rather relatively short week. Everything fits nicely into one page. We're going to do is, obviously, we're going to start, I think, with the VMedia article, because even though it's obviously comes before last week's podcast, it was actually written just after the podcast was cut. So technically it is within this week's podcast.
Yeah, so it's the actual podcast, the editing took a little longer than normal, so we released it a day later. But the item was written after we actually recorded the previous podcast. So it actually fits within the window between the previous podcast recording and what we're doing now. So yeah, it's a good item to cover, and it kind of like it kind of moves forward a bit from the discussion that we had regarding Sony last week. So it's a good fit to start with this. We do have to introduce ourselves, though. So I'm Tom Holwarda, as always, and
I'm Croc Kamen.
Okay. Do you want to introduce this item, or should I? You
can. I'll do the introducing, I think, because obviously you're the minidisc guru here, and I have no experience with the format. I mean, VMedia, this is a new attempt at putting optical drives into, well, just about anything, really. Netbooks, they've even demonstrated the possibility of a mobile phone, an optical drive in a mobile phone. Please stop laughing. And these things are incredibly cute. Oh, they're lovely. They're even smaller than a mini disc. In fact, they're just a bit larger than an SD card, a bit more squarer than oblong. And the idea here is to bring new optical media to all these devices that don't have are too small to have CD drives, netbooks included.
Yeah, the big benefit is, of course, is that a lot of people have been saying that we should, like, at least the media company should move towards selling SD cards with, or at least memory cards with pre-filled with content. And I believe SanDisk has actually started an initiative in that direction. I don't know exactly what it's called, but the big problem, of course, that SD cards are, even though you might think that they're very cheap, if you go to the shop and you want to buy like a 4 GB SD card, it's only like, I don't know, 15 euros or something. And that may not sound very expensive, but if you compare it to how expensive it would be to make an optical media, it's not that expensive, because one of these VMedia discs is probably maybe like 14, 15 cents to make. It's really, really cheap. So that's really a benefit for media companies who have to push out like millions of these things if this were to ever take off, obviously. So it's the benefits here are mostly, I think, for the media companies. Apart from the price, we also have the fact that they're apparently copy protected. So that's also really good for them. And I think what's pretty good is that it's a standard. And people may think that an SD card is a standard. Well, the format itself is a standard. But the way the content is written on an SD card, like which codec is being used or, you know, that sort of thing, that's actually not standardized.
You could have completely up in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, so you could buy an SD card, and you would never be sure if it would actually play on your. You could probably get it to play on your computer, because it's really easy to add codecs and get all that working. That's not a problem. Just, you know, install like the Kalite codec pack and choose the full version. You get like 27 million codecs, and everything will ever always play. But especially when it comes to mobile devices, this simply isn't the case. To most mobile devices, you can't actually add codec support. So if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, period. And, you know, of course, it's a myriad of codecs that one device supports this codec, the other device, you know, doesn't. And then, you know, it's a complete mess. And in that sense, sort of standardized optical drive, more in line with CDs, DVDs, mini discs, and Blu-ray and that sort of thing. It's actually, if you look at it, it's not that weird of a choice. It's just that it sounds kind of backward, but that's because people are looking at it from the perspective of the consumer. But you have to look at this from the perspective of the media companies. And for them, this is actually a pretty good solution. I still don't think it will take off, but it's actually a pretty good solution compared to using SD cards or those sorts of things. Because, you know, I don't know what your thoughts about this are. But
it's a real chicken and egg problem. It's a great idea, great technology, of course. What it is essentially, it's a bit like what a mini disc is. A mini disc is just a scaled down CD. Well, isn't it DVD actually? A scaled down DVD. It uses a different format of burning, which is rather than cylindrical, it's DVD format, so it crams more in. Well, basically, a V-Media disc is basically a tiny, tiny little Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, they're in 1 and 2 gigabyte capacities dual layer, which doesn't sound a lot, obviously, when we're talking about SD cards being, you know, 4, 8 gigabyte quite easily, and even USB pens you can pick up for, you know, a couple of quid for a gigabyte USB stick. So it's nothing impressive, really, immediately, but it is down to that fact that it's just so cheap to press a disk out compared to having to make the chips for a flash device. It was a chicken and egg problem is that people aren't really going to buy VMedia discs unless there's VMedia drives to put them into, and it's very uphill struggle for them to get into any kind of position of ubiquity. Nothing currently has a VMedia drive, so therefore the content producers are not going to produce VMedia discs because there's nothing to sell them, nobody to sell them to, and shops are not going to stock them because there are, you know, it's unlikely that they're going to sell. It's an uncertain territory. It's a bit like the whole UMD movie thing.
Yeah, well, the big thing that they have to, if they want this to succeed, again, I don't think it will, but if they at least want to have a shot, they have to get two things done. First, get as many big companies behind your project as possible. So they've already, the technology itself has actually been developed by I believe it was Panasonic, right? Let me see. It was Panasonic. Yeah, it was Panasonic. So which is a pretty big company. So that's, you know, it's good to have a company like that, you know,
co-creators
supporting
of the original CD.
Yeah, so that's pretty good. But of course, you have to have more people behind your effort. But you're gonna. I don't think that right now Sony will ever jump behind something like this. Just to, I don't think they will. But you know, that's the first thing that you have to do. You can't have just the content providers behind this or just the technology companies. You have to have both, and that's, you know, that's going to be, like you said, an uphill battle. And I don't think they're gonna get there. So that's definitely something that's really important that they have to. That's something that they have to get done, and I don't think they will. So it's kind of I don't think it's going to work. Actually, I really like the technology. For some reason, I just kind of like these mini disc like things. I have no idea why, because they're not necessarily that practical compared to having just massive storage available all the time. But they just have some. They have a certain cuteness, a certain I don't know, je ne sais quoi, to be really cliched up. I just don't know, but I don't think it's going to be a massive success, though.
Yeah, in order to get anywhere with this, they're going to need just a blitzkrieg of the it's got to appear everywhere at once. But I think they're going about this perhaps the wrong way around. I mean, failing success with the content providers, they're saying that it's going to come out as read-only discs to begin with, but they're looking at doing recordable discs and drives for 2010. And really, they should be doing this perhaps the other way around, in that if you want to get people to support a platform, you should be able to get people writing to it, so that there is content out there. Because if you can put these discs into netbooks, then people can use them as a backup device to carry their stuff around, because you've got small storage in netbooks, and people can start getting used to the discs, and then that will increase the popularity of the drive, such that the content producers will then want to target them.
Yeah.
Doing this as a read-only to begin with, I think, is going to be a bit of an uphill struggle.
Yeah, well, that I just said before in this discussion that I was going to mention two things that they have to get right, but I forgot the second one. But indeed, that's the fact that they're at this point read only, and there's not yet a writable medium. So if they wanted to start the push, the actual big push towards getting these things everywhere, indeed, the first thing that they have to get right is getting them writable and making them writable. So right now, I don't think anyone is going to buy into this. So the Acer machine that's you know, been documented now is probably more of a proof of concept kind of thing, right? So that VMedia can use this machine to say, hey, look, it works. And I don't think it's actually going to sell even. It's more of a prototype kind of thing. But still, it's pretty cool.
Very tacked on. It looks pretty ugly. The logo is horrible. We don't need one yet more logos stuck to a laptop already. And I don't get the idea of a flip up thing. That's just more parts, more things to break. It would be much better if it was slot loading. The other thing is, you mentioned last week about obviously the UMDs not having the cover on them. They don't have the metal cover on them, so they get scratched. Yeah. But thankfully, with VMedia, they have sorted. They've sorted that, so it has got a nice metal catch on it.
Yeah, that's pretty good, because that was one of my first things that I started to check out when I started looking at the actual disc. I was hoping that they really had the little metal clasp, so to speak, flown over the actual disc part, because that's just some brain dead decision regarding UMD that I never understood. But yeah, that's pretty good. So the discs themselves will probably be just as rugged as the actual mini discs are. And as I said last week, you can do anything with mini discs; they'll never break. I mean, it's really hard to actually break a mini disc, and for these things, it will be the same. And they're just small and cute. I mean, how can you not love those tiny little? I just don't understand.
They are terribly cute. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not going to sell them, obviously, but still, it's pretty cool.
It might. I don't know. That's probably going to be their only selling point. They're so cute.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, but no, I don't think it's going to be a success, but still, it's at least.
Oh, sorry, you carry on.
No, you can move on.
Well, I was just going to say, there's not much to be said about it. It's a nice technology and all, but it just seems a little backwater given how popular downloading is now, how popular, flash media is. The proof is going to be when you start seeing them in products, in shops, and in netbooks. Are people going to be going towards this product or going away from it? They're going to look at that and think, "Eh, don't want that," or they're going to think, "Ah, I want that." So the results, I think, will be just simply if you can walk into PC World and there is six laptops in there or whatever that have got this VMedia drive in it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, stuff like this is really hard to predict, actually, like what format is going to be the big king. It's really problematic. So people who, there's always a chance that they're going to get it right, that there's some stroke of luck or some divine intervention or something that pushes, for some weird reason, pushes everybody in the same direction. So it's not impossible. I mean, I'm never going to say that it's impossible. And people who are saying that it is by definition impossible, I don't think that's a wise thing to say, because it's always possible in when it comes to formats, for some format that may seem really backwards to still catch on. I think, CD, technically a CD is completely backwards and problematic compared to a mini disc, but still, the CD is of course much more ubiquitous than a mini disc has ever been. So, it's not about technical superiority all the time. It's also about who gets behind what format. So, they can still make it, but it's likely it's not going to happen. But it's still possible.
I mean, they haven't got Apple's blessing or Microsoft's blessing, then that obviously makes things all the much harder. You've got all the mobile phone manufacturers trying to get behind the idea of a unified charger, which, of course, then you're going to have Apple on the side as well, who will never go along with that sort of thing. You're always going to get one player in the market who's just really stubborn and only wants to go their way, and they really drag their feet.
Yeah. That's also, of course, going to be... If they're going to get, like... If VMedia can get, like, something like Microsoft or something behind this... but not even that is, like, a guarantee, because HD DVD didn't make it either, right? So it's...
Oh yeah, Microsoft were behind that with the Xbox 360. So
So it's really, even if you have like a really big player behind you, it still doesn't guarantee success. But at the same time, not having really big players behind you doesn't automatically mean you're not going to make it either. And that's what I mean by predicting the future of something like this is really difficult. You can never exclude certain outcomes of when it comes to formats or media. It's really really difficult to make proper predictions. So it. Of course, they don't have the odds in favor, but that, again, doesn't mean that they're not going to make it by definition. So it's, the technology itself is really, really new. It was only revealed late last year. So for a media, that's really, really new, actually. So OS News is reporting on it pretty soon, actually, because usually it takes like years and years before something like this starts to catch on. So, it can go any way. But yeah, like we said, the likely way is never. Technically.
Well, I mean, if it does catch on and become ubiquitous, then we'll finally have a storage medium that actually looks like all of the television shows and films we've had for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, they don't ever use CDs or floppy disks. It's always some magical little cube or some little mini disk. Well, they have used mini disks and things like that. They don't ever just use, you know, typical storage medium. It's always got a futuristic.
Yeah, because they're not sexy enough. I mean, if you come in with a CD, I mean, it's just impractical. The cool jackets that the action heroes are wearing, they don't have space for CDs. Or, like, little memory cards are, like, little plastic nothings. They're not, like, manly at all. And, and just, like mini discs.
That's what we're lacking with CD. It's not manly enough.
Yeah, it's too large and not manly, and it doesn't fit in, like, a Gucci handbag. So it's just not practical. So, you know, after joking around, of course. But still, I mean, it's going to be an uphill battle. I mean, I hope it actually works. Because, like I said, I like these things, but I'm just weird. So, you know, that's just, I'm rooting for them, but I fear the worst, actually.
It's going to be very difficult making a small stack of them. I mean, you can stack DVDs quite easily, but I can't imagine a stack of these, you know, a couple of foot high. It's going to be a bit difficult.
Well, it works with mini. It works with mini discs, but these things are like infinitely smaller. So yeah, it's going to be difficult. They're going to topple over real quick. So, but then again, you can just throw them around anyway, so it doesn't matter. They're not going to break. I mean,
oh. Shall we move on?
Uh-huh. I think that's a good idea.
We've got Why Linux is Not Yet Ready for the Desktop. Just exploded and hemorrhaged across the database.
Yeah, let's make a. I've got a really good discussion that takes like 10 seconds. People, read the comments. Moving on.
Thank you.
Yeah. what can we do? We could talk about the Palm Prey or Prey or Pre or whatever it's called in English. I just call it Prey because that's Dutch. So, Palm Prey.
Know much about it. I'm not a mobile phone person. I hate mobile phones. I think they're incredibly rude. Unfortunately, I have to have one because of business. I don't even like the iPhone. In fact, I hate the iPhone. I think it's just a horrible device. I understand that it's the future, certainly, but I still dislike it.
I dislike the iPhone probably even more because it doesn't... I mean, I could go on for hours, but I'm not going to because people will think that I'm just anti-Apple.
Devote a whole show to complaints about the iPhone.
Yeah, my mother has one, and I try to use it as much as possible. So, like, every day, because, you know, they live in the same village as I do, so that's not a problem. And I just don't like it. To me, people say that it's intuitive, but there are so many things in there that just doesn't make any sense to me. For instance, if you're, like, viewing a web page and you want to go to the little field where you can enter the URL, there's no logical way to get there, but apparently I have to double tap on the device, and then it pops up. But to me, I was like trying to figure that out for like 10 minutes or something. Maybe I'm an idiot. I don't know. Well, I am an idiot, obviously, but I was trying to find out how that worked. And there are all sorts of these little things that just don't make sense to me.
You haven't been following the marketing closely enough.
No, I haven't been indoctrinated. sorry, I haven't been... no, that's true. My mother just... Yeah, I just don't like it. In addition to that, I think it's the device actually really, really slow. So loading applications is just... I think it's a horrendous experience. I mean, you have to tap on an icon, and then you have to wait for like 10 minutes, and then the application finally pops up. And you have to do it every time because it can't even, you know, multitask, right? Because they really skimped on the processor, on the ROM, on that device. And as we all... And they're touting the iPhone OS as being macOS 10 in a box, right? But we all know that macOS 10 just doesn't handle low memory conditions very, very well. So I just... It doesn't really make sense to me to... convert your desktop operating system, which is known to be heavy on the memory side of things, and then move that over to a small device and then skimp on the memory. It just didn't make any sense to me, and it shows because stuff just loads too slow. So there are a lot of talks right now, also from John Gruber from Daring Fireball, that the next iPhone will have like a much faster processor, more ROM and everything. And I really hope that it does get that because it would make the phone itself a lot faster. And that's one of the reasons why I don't like it. But moving on to the Prey, or the Prey, or the, well, whatever. The videos that we've seen of it, and sadly, it are only videos, and two, all the videos were demonstrations by Palm itself. So it is a bit, you know, how much value can you give to that sort of information, but still. There's most likely a much faster processor in the Prey and more ROM, so, and that shows. And it actually loads applications much faster than the iPhone does, even when a couple of applications are running at the same time. So it's, I do think it's a better phone, even though I haven't used it. So it's just, you know, it, I can't really base it on anything else than what everyone else has already seen. But I do think it is the better phone compared to the iPhone. But again, that doesn't really mean anything because obviously Apple has the brand. Palm has a brand as well, but it's not as universal and as appealing as the Apple brand right now. On top of that, you have the whole thing with the rebates, and rebates are evil.
I don't understand that. I obviously know what a rebate is, but it's not very common here in the UK. But I don't understand, what's this idea of what's an instant rebate? Is that where you fill in the piece of paper and hand it back to them and then give you the money that you just gave them or something? What
I mean, I know the concept of like a normal rebate in the United States, right? Because that's when you like buy something and then there's a little form attached and you have to fill it in, send it in, and then like 25 years later, you're going to get your money back. That's basically the general gist of the whole thing. But this is like an instant rebate, and like you just said, what the hell is an instant rebate? Does that mean that you like hand over $300 and then you fill something in and then you hand in the piece of paper and then you get $100 back? I don't get it. Maybe I really don't understand what that means. But in any case, it's a nuisance, and it's just a little trick to make it seem as if the device is actually cheaper than
exactly
it is.
That's exactly what it is. It's just a trick to try and make it look the same price ultimately as the iPhone, because that's what they're competing against. In fact, speaking of competing in the iPhone, they're obviously say that they're going to announce the Palm Pre. It's going to be available on June the 6th, which is just a couple of days before Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference.
Yeah,
which is a bit like farting into a windstorm.
No, I think it's actually a pretty brilliant idea, because if they're going to release this thing on June 6th, that also means that the onslaught of blog posts and reviews will all start coming June 6th, right? So. If they would have released it like a month earlier, that the Palm Prey storm would have already been
good.
would have already been gone, and then all the attention during WWDC, or the can we just call it DC, because I really hate saying W. So
have
all
you
the I'm just gonna call it DC. You guys have to keep up with me here. So if they would have if they would have released it a month sooner, so like at the beginning of May, and then the DC would start. And then all the talk would be focused solely on the iPhone. But right now, because the Prey was just released 2 days earlier, everyone is going to compare it definitely, without a doubt. Everyone's going to compare the new features in the iPhone, the new operating system, so like version 3, and as well any possible new iPhones that might pop up. They're all going to compare it to the Prey, no matter what. If they had released the Prey a month earlier, that wouldn't have been a sure thing as it is now. So I don't think it's that bad of an idea, actually.
I think I personally would see two problems with their decision there. I mean, first of all, is that rumor is more interesting than reality. And when the rumor mill starts cranking out its wares, it's just going to just blot everything out. You know, iPhone news makes the top of the page, regardless if it's right or wrong or whatever. In fact, if it's complete fanciful rubbish. In fact, sometimes mock-ups that are known to be made mock-ups make the news. It just gets stupid. You know, things get really stupid around Apple developer conferences.
Yeah,
And that might blot out the Palm Prey.
But not necessarily on non-Apple websites, right? So. You know, the Apple websites are going to focus on the iPhone anyway. I mean, Palm Prey or no Palm Prey, because, you know, you every fart from Cupertino is being reported by those guys.
And they're reporting then on each other. And
the LinkedIn set just goes on and on. It's a sort of, I'm not necessarily sure if that's a word that I should use here, but it's kind of like an incest website ring. I mean, it's there. Some of them, even the Infinite Loop at Ars Technica is starting to, you know, go down that route. But anyway, let's just talk about those guys. Anyway, what was I going to say? So basically the Apple websites are going to report on the iPhone anyway. So but the other websites, you know, like the Register and CNET and all those things, and even us guys, we are of course the awesomest, that's obvious. We're gonna and non other non-Apple websites as well. They're gonna talk about both. anyway. So I think I don't think that's that much of a problem, because the Apple websites are going to talk about the iPhone anyway, pray or no pray. So I don't think that's going to be a problem.
I think, as I was saying, with the second problem I see is that the timing could potentially be bad, a bit like when a film gets released right next to another film that is that it's going to be a box office hit regardless. Like, you know, Spider-Man, when first Spider-Man comes out, the film was released, you know, the week before, then, or a couple of days before, then you had no hope. And the thing is that with the Palm Pre, if they release it and then Apple suddenly come out with something that is, you know, significantly all more the singing and dancing, then people are going to probably not go for buying the Pre because they've got something that's now just appeared better with bigger razzmatazz. For example, it's so close that people are going to actually sit and wait for the whatever's going to happen at WWDC first before going out to buy a Pre. So they could be shooting themselves in the foot there if Apple come out with something even, you know, better.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that Palm does have some sort of an idea of what Apple is going to come up with, because Palm is a big boy. I mean, even though the company isn't doing very well right now, it still is a big boy in the whole mobile phone and the now dead PDA business. And of course, some Apple engineers actually work at Palm now, so there are lines of contact between the two companies that we have no idea of, right? So I do think Palm has a much better understanding, a much clearer understanding of what Apple is going to do during the developers conference than that we have. So for us, it's still all a mystery, but I don't think it's necessarily a mystery to Palm. So they have more knowledge than we do, and based on that knowledge, it probably made sense for them to say, well, hey, we're not going to wait until after the conference or whatever. We're going to do it in front. So it probably still is an element of luck in there, but I do think they have more knowledge than we do, which probably makes it easier for them to make the decision to put the phone out there on June 6th. So
another thing I think I've just looking at this article noticed is that in fact there's two things to discuss, but I'll first say that I think Palm Pre is if they've obviously made, now that they've made the official announcement of it, release date pricing, etc. and everything, and so we know that it's on June the 6th, they've let off all the steam, they've let off all the hype now, and we're just waiting for it to actually be released. Whereas with Apple and with WWDC, then it's where all the hype and all the steam builds up. Palm should have kept off announcing it, announcing a lot of the details or any official announcement until the actual 6th, and should have announced it on the 6th, so that we would have its own rumour mill and hype building up. But they've let that all off now, so we know exactly what it is and when it's going to be, and it's right before WWDC where there is going to be so much hype. I think that they should have just held on a little bit tighter and let the information slip a bit more closer to the time. I just think that all the actual all the suspense has gone now from the Palm Pre.
Yeah, but you know, there's two ways of looking at this, because at the one hand, you know, all the hype may be gone, but we know all the factual information. Well, you know, all the stuff that builds up towards the developers conference, towards the DC, that's just a hot air balloon anyway. So that runs out at the moment Phil Schiller starts talking, right? Then it's over. But with the Prey, it lasts a little longer.
RSS gets raped for the next week, though.
Yeah, I don't use RSS anyway, so I don't get bombarded with all that nonsense. But yeah, I know I'm weird. But it probably is a gamble, and you know, I'm not an industry insider or whatever, so it's hard for me to or for you anyway to.
I wouldn't know anyway. No.
Yeah, so it's kind of a.
I don't use. You know, I wouldn't buy such a device anyway. I don't know. I know far less about this than I know about the iPhone. And secondly, I can't actually view their website because it's just one giant, great, big, empty page because I don't have Flash.
Oh no, that's not the Palm website. That's the website for from Sprint, actually. So from the
That's the other thing I wanted to say is that other people have been mentioning that whole thing, Sprint, having a problem with that, because people have said that the service isn't particularly good, the price is expensive, and as bad as AT&T are, apparently Sprint are even worse.
Well, the pricing thing is one that I wanted to comment on, because I thought it would be more expensive than the iPhone as well, but then someone from Ars Technica made a comparison that The cheapest plan that you can buy the Prey with is actually cheaper than the cheapest iPhone plan, because the cheapest iPhone plan doesn't come with a number of things that you have to add in order to get to the same level of the cheapest. I've made a comment about that somewhere. Note, it seems the pricing for the Palm Spray Everything plan isn't nearly as expensive compared to the iPhone as it seemed at first sight. And then the guy wrote on Ars Technica that, in all fairness, that $17 Sprint plan gets you 450 daytime minutes and unlimited data, unlimited text, and unlimited use of their commercial navigation service. To get the same on an iPhone would be $40 for the 450 minutes, $30 for unlimited data, and $20 for unlimited text, for a total of $90 a month. And then you wouldn't obviously have the commercial nav service, because it doesn't exist. So it's not really it may sound expensive at first, but when you start doing the actual rundown of what you're getting, it's actually quite a lot cheaper than the cheapest iPhone plan. So that's not...
I mean, relatively speaking, the iPhone is ridiculously expensive as it is already. I mean, here in the UK, it's pretty much a joke, because we've had very, very hot mobile phone competition in here for the last 5 years, and things pretty cheap, relatively speaking. I mean, mobile phones, it's a price fixing anyway, but it's all it's cheap compared to the iPhone, especially the fact that you have to pay for the data plan, and you get barely any text, and you get barely any minutes compared to what you can haggle down here.
That's one thing I wanted to mention that really surprised me. The prices of the prices of having the pleasure to own a mobile phone, the costs are so extremely high in the United States compared to what we pay here in the Netherlands. Obviously, our country is much smaller, so it was probably easier to set up the network, right?
But tin cans and string back there.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I pay, and I have a relatively expensive one because mine is already like 10 million years old. But I pay like 25 euros, and I have basically unlimited everything. So it's so much cheaper here in at least in the Netherlands than it is in the United States. It really surprised me. But anyway, I was interrupting you, so go ahead.
Oh no, I had nothing useful to say.
Oh. Well, let me think.
But we're going to be reporting on the news as it comes out as regards to Palm Prey. We're not going to ignore that come all the WWDC rumor mill. In fact, it'd be best if we avoid any of the actual rumor rubbish anyway. And
yeah, we always do that.
And only actually announce the actual announcements from Apple as it comes out of Phil Schiller on stage.
Yeah, we used to do like a little like rumor rundown like the day before or something, but I'm not even bothering anymore because 99% is just complete nonsense anyway. So it's a waste of my typing skills and a waste of my fingertips. So I'm not even, you know. I mean,
Netbook.
Apple Netbook. Is there going to be
Apple Netbook?
Yeah, maybe if we say it like 10 million times, finally Apple will finally listen. But no, I don't think so. Well, I don't have anything else to add to the whole Prey. I hope it's going to be a success because more competition is always better, and I think the device itself is really sexy, the interface is cool and everything. So I hope it's going to be a success. But again, that's one thing that I wanted to mention. The Palm Prey doesn't have to kill the iPhone to be a success for Palm. Because so many people are saying, oh, if the Palm Prey doesn't kill the iPhone, then they're lost, or it won't kill the iPhone. Well, obviously it won't kill the iPhone. I mean, the iPhone is already a massive platform. It's here to stay. It won't go away. And I don't think that's the goal. The goal for Palm is to make sure the company survives, and they've put all their eggs in the Prey basket, so in the webOS basket. So it doesn't have to kill the iPhone. It won't kill the iPhone. It just has to sell as many units as possible, and it's just something that I wanted to add here.
Not everybody wants the iPhone. Not everybody can afford an iPhone. There's always going to be room for, you know, more than one phone out there, and they just want to be that other phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic.
Moving on. What else do we have on the front page? Safari is again very slow to load, as always, on my old Power Mac.
Just above that, we have to bring a bit of balance, OS News being impartial-ish. We want to talk about the 9-month-old critical Java vulnerability just stuck in Mac OS X. Because last week we bashed Windows 7 a lot for their UAC blunder. And this is Apple doing just the same sort of thing.
Yeah, this is... you should probably talk about... You're the web guy. You probably know something about Java, right? Or am
web
I making
guy,
it?
I wouldn't touch Java with a barge pole.
No, neither would I, but still.
I uninstalled Flash. I mean, I uninstalled Java, but it's part of Mac OS X.
Yeah, but you're closer to that than I am, so you can... an inch closer than I am.
I haven't loaded a piece of Java in I don't know how many years. I have it switched off by default in my browsers. And Windows, I never installed it anyway. I don't like plugins in browsers because it's just a world of hurt. But basically, the situation in Mac OS X, or correction, I should say Mac OS 10, because Adam Scheinberg, a web developer who's been listening, apparently just bursts into fits of giggle every time I say OS X instead
Please
of
keep
what
on saying
to be,
it.
OS 10.
It's awesome. Because
I like saying OS X.
Yeah, same thing. I used to say it all the time, but then I participated in a Dutch Mac podcast a couple of times, and I said Mac OS X as well. And they didn't want me to say it like that. They were pretty adamant about
lie.
It. Yeah, so I started saying Mac OS 10, and it kind of stuck, so, you know. But just continue.
I read it as it is. Well, basically, the situation in Apple's Mac operating system version 10.5 Leopard is that they bake their own Java. Normally, you're used to Windows that you download and install it, and it's provided by Sun Oracle themselves. But in Mac OS X, it's actually a re-implementation by Apple. It gives it a tighter system integration. It also means you don't get a stupid tray icon. It doesn't mean you get bubbles in the corner telling you need to update. It doesn't install the Yahoo toolbar. So there's a lot of good things about Java on Mac OS X. It's of all the Java implementations, it's the one I like the most because it's the most transparent. It is what it's supposed to be, a programming language that just runs things. So yeah. It's quite nice on Mac OS X. But the problem here is that Apple have been lagging behind because it's their own implementation. Any security fixes they've got to then write themselves and implement and then push out to the security updates. And this is one that's just been sitting there for 6 months ago. It was
9 months
by
actually. 9 months, because it was reported 9 months ago, so it has been known.
Existed for 9 months and then actually patched by Sun 3 months after that.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole thing is it took a long time, didn't it, for Apple to ship Java 6, because Leopard came with Java 5, and there's a huge hoo-ha, even remember it on OS News, about, they didn't include Java 6, oh, Mac OS 10 sucks. And then eventually, 3 or 4 months down the line, can't remember the exact date, they then pushed out Java 6 update for Mac OS X. I mean, the clock has started. Let's see how long it takes until they finally solve this one.
Yeah, it's technically a pretty interesting flaw. I mean, I don't understand every aspect of it, obviously, because I'm not a programmer, let alone a Java programmer. But from what I understood, it's a pretty interesting exploit because it will work. It really is a write once exploit everything. Or what's that little sort of joke that I made?
Write once, run everywhere.
Yeah, let me see. Write once, exploit everywhere, because it really does do that. But the flaw has been fixed, and Apple has been lagging behind. And it's not the first time that this happens. I mean, I believe Mac OS X is still shipping old variants of all sorts of open source frameworks and parts that are known to have. I'm not sure if the situation with Leopard is still the same, because I haven't been following that whole area as closely as I used to. But it used to be at least the case that a lot of open source parts of the Mac operating system were lagging behind in updates from Apple. So
that is an issue.
Yeah, so that known flaws were still in Mac OS X, and they would have already been patched on all other operating systems, but not yet on the Mac.
Yeah, this is a very severe thing. I mean, we obviously complained about Windows 7 UAC being able to bypass that with a line of code. And this is along the same lines in the fact that Java is on by default in Safari. All the attacker needs to do is just execute some Java, and they've basically escaped the sandbox and can do anything they want to the computer. So, I mean, you can quite easily go around formatting people's hard disks or something on Macs. It's, or even better, I mean, what the other guy did with the Trojan is make a botnet out of it.
Yeah, so you steal data, that's the big thing, or use it as a spammer machine, that's pretty cool, of course. But the proof of concept just invoked the say command, the Unix say command, but it's just a harmless little thing. But it's a pretty interesting and pretty big bug that at this time, this point in time, only affects macOS 10. So it's really going to be a waiting game to see if Apple will fix this one. And you know, a lot of sites are reporting on it, luckily, so that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think what we should discuss really with this is not so much the exploit itself, because they come and go. It's just really Apple's whole security process is extremely lazy. Apple use and ship a lot of open source on macOS 10. It is an almost, in fact, it is a developer's dream. It is a platform that most developers use. Even Linux developers use macOS X because it has everything baked in and just ready out of the box, and you don't have to go through config files and so forth. You've got Ruby on there. You've got Python. It comes with Apache, PHP, SVN, everything, all in there straight away. You can just switch the computer on and you've got a development box. So it's very good for that. But the problem is Apple do not push these updates through for these software. You've got to either wait for a major point update where they might, you know, update these things, since they're doing such a large thing anyway, or you've got to recompile it yourself. And it really is a bit of a headache. Their whole security process is really lax, and they're just resting on the laurels because there hasn't been anything major really attacking the platform. I think the only thing to speak of note is that botnet is the only really serious thing that's happened in so many years.
Yeah. So, but you know, you can't ride on a track record forever. I mean, at one point something is going to happen. I mean, the Mac is really popular. I'm not saying that because I hate Mac or because I want to Apple destroyed or that sort of thing, but just because it is eventually inevitable, because there is going to be a tipping point where it will be interesting enough financially for these evil people, these evil crackers, to actually attack macOS 10. I mean, it never has been, but there's going to be a tipping point. And people say that that's a myth, right? But it's not a myth. Obviously, if there's money to be made, they're gonna abuse it, and then they're gonna have this whole list, this readily available list of flaws in the Mac operating system because of all the open source parts. I mean, they can just check, okay, what version is Apple using? Okay, that version is like, I don't know, like 18 months old. We'll just check at the open source original project website, and we're gonna see what kind of flaws are all open. And then every Mac user has that exact same flaw open, except a few geeks who have actually compiled their own compiled their own code. And I think you could probably count those guys on like two hands or something. So it is like a ready-made available list of exploits that you can use, and Apple has been pretty lax with that one. And they did hire the OLPC security guy, Kristic or something. I don't know his name from the top. So that could be like a sign that they're
With his, he designed the Bitfrost system for OPLC, which is a very humanitarian security system designed with the whole idea of what the OPLC is, rather than what the operating system is. So, WWDC, we should hopefully see something. I mean, first of all, it's a guarantee we're going to get a demo of Snow Leopard. That's probably the most interesting thing that I'm looking forward to is to seeing what Snow Leopard is, because I really loved that before the iPhone, and they got distracted for hours and hours with that. When before Tiger came out, the WWDC there, they did, you know, they spent hours. I think the keynote was almost 3 hours long, and they covered they demonstrated all of the Leopard Tiger technology. They demonstrated core video, and they demonstrated core image. It was just fantastic, a real geek fest. And they haven't done anything that serious since, so I'm hoping with Snow Leopard they're actually, because there's not going to be so much on visual differences, that hopefully they are going to go into to the actual under the hood stuff that they've been doing there, and that we'll see if the security process has improved as such.
Yeah, because as for geeks, the keynotes from Apple haven't been really interesting lately. Like you said, it's like it's a 5 minute talk on the operating system, you know, a bit exaggerated, but still, like, it's like a short talk on the actual operating system that we're interested in, and then it's like a continuous showing of figures of how many iTunes songs they sold, and then like a new iPod with a slightly bigger screen and a bigger hard drive, and they're going to talk about that one for 2 hours on end. So for me, it's just not really interesting. I don't have an iPod, I don't have an iPhone, I don't care either. So it's not really interesting. But I want talk about the Mac operating system. That's what I'm interested in. I want talks about actual Mac hardware. You know, that's interesting. That's what I care about. I don't care about the fact that they changed the color of the display cover or something. I'm interested in like the technology behind it. You know, that's what interests me. But and as of late, they haven't been really talking about that a whole lot. And Snow Leopard is a really good chance to talk about the technology behind it, because you know, it's going to be a release focusing on rumors aside, that is, because there are rumors that there's going to be a new interface and everything, but we'll see. But, you know, the focus is on the technical aspects of the operating system and making it faster and taking out PPC code and all that sort of thing. And then, you know, so the only thing they technically could talk about is the actual core. So I hope it's going to be something interesting this time. But we'll see. It's a couple of days, right? It's not like 9th or something. June 9th, right? Or yeah. Oh, June 8th, obviously. Yeah. So that's going to be interesting, definitely.
Nicely wraps things up. We've got another big topic next, I think, so we want to sink our teeth into that. Ex-Microsoft employee baits the internet by saying free software will kill Microsoft.
Yeah, I love that headline. I mean, it's not a sensationalist headline. It is what he said. Don't look at me. I just you know, put down what he said. Don't look at me. It's not my fault. Don't kill me. So now that we got that out of the way, let me see. How can you introduce something like this?
It's a person who worked at Microsoft for 11 years, a complete Microsoftie, obviously, being very involved. It worked on Windows, worked on Office, hadn't even touched Linux until he'd actually finished. You know, he'd moved on from his job.
Yeah,
and then, whoosh, was swept to the dark side. And,
yeah.
And I said that now that the free software model is going to be the eventual downfall of Microsoft.
Well, I don't like it when people think in terms of like we just talked about the iPhone being
one killing another.
Yeah, one killing. I just don't like that. In the end, it should be a compliment, right? It should be complimentary. So the past couple of years.
Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, so like open source software and both open source software and Apple have pushed Microsoft to produce better software. And that's what I want to see, right? And right now, you know, that's good. And at the same time, the closed source guys, so to speak, are pushing the open source guys to make better code. So it's a good way to get both to improve, but having something completely eradicated, which means that open source will only become complacent and it will just be the next, you know, it just won't work. Competition is good. Competition between closed and open is what you want. You just want it to be a bit more fairly distributed, right? So that you have more open source software on desktops and everything. But the whole idea of one killing another, I just don't see it happen, and I don't like the idea behind it.
Well, if anything, I mean, this article, why we want to cover this versus, say, the Linux desktop article earlier on is, well, this person obviously has some experience to speak from and some position within Microsoft, you know, helping to code Windows itself, having to be part of that competition, and then now being on the other side of that. So he's got some credence to what he says. I'm with you as well, obviously, that it's not going to be one killing the other, but open source really, it pressurizes Microsoft. There's something I read very recently, is it on an OS News article, that made me think of this by proxy, which is, it's the Microsoft to remove the 3-app limit from the operating system we shall not name.
It's not a bug, it's a feature.
Oh my exactly, God. But now, what happens is that if we lived without open source operating systems, if we didn't have open source operating systems, Microsoft could pull stunts like that and get away with it, because that's all there would be. They would have this dictatorship of that when Microsoft says jump, everybody jumps. And yeah. What I like with open source operating systems is that whilst I don't think they are quite up to par with all aspects of what Microsoft offer, they do, however, pressurize Microsoft to act in a more open and more consumer-friendly manner. And if we didn't have that pressure on there, Microsoft would be able to pull off a lot more stunts, a bit like Apple, really, who some people like them, obviously, because they take away needless decisions. And then at the same point, people complain because Apple are taking away needless decisions.
Yeah.
And it's like that. Apple dictate where the operating systems go. When Apple say jump, everybody jumps. When they remove a feature from iTunes, you have no choice because there's no real competition for iTunes on OS X. I'm getting stuck saying OS X now. I've got to stop doing that. I'm going to say OS X. Like Songbird, but I've used it on OS X. It's a joke. It doesn't compete at all. So for Microsoft, for Windows, yes, absolutely. I think it's a situation whereby we're going to have we can't have one killing off the other. They've got to live together, and that's the hardest thing. That's the thing that Microsoft are finding difficult. They're struggling with. They're struggling with living with open source.
Yeah, well,
they're like roommates that don't get on.
Well, luckily I never had a roommate, so I don't know that analogy. But I think instead of trying to focus on like killing the other or looking at the amount of installations that they've achieved or their market share, I think the free software world, you start to look at I think their biggest accomplishment is pushing Microsoft to actually change their software. I think that's the biggest accomplishment of the open source and the free software movement. And by the way, I don't care about the differences, okay? Open source, free software, I use them interchangeably. Don't whine about it.
Yeah, let's have an hour discussion on the difference between GNU Linux and Linux.
Yeah, I don't really care. So basically, I mean, stuff where you can look at the code and change it without being shot. So that's basically open source. There we go. Now, moving on. I think that's the biggest achievement of open source is that it actually pushed a tremendous company that has a 90% market share in the operating system world to actually change their stuff. So open source pushed Microsoft to improve their server offerings. They made the Windows Server operating system better. And right now, I'm basically seeing only positive aspects, people being positive about Windows Server, being positive about the IIS, which is a really weird acronym, by the way, that IIS really improved. And so they pushed Microsoft to improve on the server side of things. They pushed Microsoft to improve their offerings in the Office world, actually, because they could have kept on releasing Office 2003 for forever. But instead, they realized that they had to change something, that they had to come up with something new. If open source hadn't been there, if Open Office hadn't been there, Microsoft wouldn't have done that as drastically as they've done. So that's a good thing, right? So there's more competition
now. Yeah, they distanced themselves from Open Office significantly with 2007, because so really, 2003, they could just release a new version with a whole new save icon and people would have heralded it.
Yeah.
So you're quite right, really. That's what matters is that Microsoft can be pushed along to go in the right direction. They can be coerced. They can be cajoled.
And now we're even seeing that. And now we're even seeing that on the desktop operating system side of things. So even if open source may not have like a market share of 50%, they did push Microsoft to get their act together and make Vista better. And they've done that with Windows 7, and of course there will always be people who say that they did not and that it's still a piece of crap, but the general opinion right now is that it's better, and I think it is. So they've pushed Microsoft on all fronts to actually improve, so it's awesome. I mean, look at that. That's like a great achievement that nobody in the open source world is actually talking about, right? They're all focusing so much on the numbers and the figures and how much market share they have and desktop ready articles and more of that nonsense. But just try and look at what you guys have already accomplished. It may not be what you originally aimed for, but it is a huge achievement that they've pushed such a big company to make so many changes and improve their products and be more consumer friendly. I think it's awesome. I mean, yay, open source. I mean, let's have a ticker tape parade. I mean, it's awesome, right?
Absolutely. We live in a world of mind-blowing technology we just could not conceive 100 years ago. And it's easy to look, not to be able to see the forest for the trees. And that's especially true with open source, of being so focused on desktop market share numbers and not being focused on users and what you've managed to achieve so far anyway. And just doing a good job rather than being so hung up on what the other guy is doing.
Yeah.
The other angle to the article is about Microsoft itself being an open source company, about if they could be doing things in an open source way. I think Microsoft cannot be an open source company. I think they can put on as much as a mask as they want, but they will never be an open source company, not at least with Monkey Boy at the top.
No, but I don't think it's going to happen anyway. Monkey Boy, that's a good one, obviously. We already said that we both don't like that guy. Anyway, I don't think they even should be an open source company, because again, that would take away the competition aspect of things. You have to have you have to have black, you have to have white, right? So you have to have proprietary. Again, change that word, please, English people, change that word. If you're Dutch, you can't pronounce it. So you have to have the closed source side of things, and you have the open side of things, and then they compete and make stuff better. That's a good thing. I mean, you don't want either of the two to disappear. And Microsoft thought that they could kill off the open source, and they couldn't. And the open source guys are thinking that they can kill off the closed source side of things, but they cannot. Just forget it. Just try to make your own stuff better. Focus on your own stuff. Let Microsoft focus on their own stuff and make a couple of stupid ads every now and then. And then it works,
right?
You
don't need Microsoft. You don't need Windows in order to improve the latest distribution of Linux. You don't need those.
No, exactly.
An individual thing. Focus on what you are doing. Look at the users. Design software to be better to use. I'm one thing that I am tired with open source software is a lot of the copying, a lot of the following Windows and Microsoft and Apple and what they do, and just the lack of immediately apparent innovation. It's happening certainly, but at the distro level, it seems like all I'm doing is using a reskinned Windows XP. And they're just polishing this and trying to follow Windows for the things. And OpenOffice just seems to be a lost cause. It just seems to be wandering down this path of following Office 2003 and has no will in it to break out and do something like Office 2007, where they sat down and seriously rethought the idea of the Windows icons, mouse pointer interface, and said, okay, this is no longer practical. Let's just go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
And I don't see that happening in a lot of open source projects. You know, going back to the drawing board and thinking, you know, this design is 25 years old. We need something new here.
I think the KDE guys did something like that.
Onto that as saying that they have taken a stab at that, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, it may not be successful in every aspect, and I still don't think that they're actually there. But, you know, I really commend them for trying. And I don't like using the word proud in when it comes to software, but I'm actually pretty proud of those guys. You know, they're really trying to do something new. They don't have, like, big millions and millions of bucks behind them or money and everything. They just... You know, they sat down even as an open source group and said, look, we have to come up with something new. The KDE3 branch is done. It's over. It's complete. We can't improve upon what we have now any longer and still be competitive. So, you know, and
stick a fork in, it's done.
Yeah, completely rethought everything from end to end, basically. And of course, it still resembles, you know, a standard desktop interface. That's obvious, because you don't want to come up with something new and snazzy, and then it may be really cool, but nobody wants to use it. So it's they really did something good there. And I wish more open source projects, especially smaller open source projects, could really benefit from something like that, to just say, look, you know, put the fork down and try and see if we can come up with something new. Just sit down with each other, with the main contributors, and have obviously an open discussion on where we want things to go. And especially OpenOffice is a great example of that. I mean, they've been, you know, maybe it is getting better, but I still find it a horrendous piece of software. I absolutely hate OpenOffice with every fiber in my body. I always get the feeling that OpenOffice is working completely against me in every possible way that is trying to hinder me and actually getting my job done. And I kind of had the same feeling with Office 2003 and previous versions of Office, that they were working against me, that they were deliberately hiding specifically those features that I needed, right? That they would dig them down, they would move around specifically to annoy me. And with the whole new, you know, the ribbon thing, I mean, a lot of people are complaining about it. But for, at least for me, it's such a tremendous step forward for Office software. And a lot of people are ridiculing it for having too many buttons on on the actual interface, but they're grouped in such a logical manner that it just makes sense. And that's the kind of thing that I want to see.
It's backed by data. It's you know, they've done the testing. They've revised it 1,000 times to make it as efficient as possible for people who are sitting in front of it and doing that job.
Yeah.
So, you know, they haven't just pulled this out of the air. They haven't just, in fact, I read an article recently. I'm probably going to have to dig it up, but it was saying that it was about the redesign of the American Airlines website, and saying that design is easy. You want to design? I've got six here, right here. You know, mocking something up in Photoshop is you know, easy. Anyone can do that. Making an interface usable is a whole different art, and that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of revision, and you don't really know what it is you're doing until you've thrown something out there, you've put it on the potter's wheel, and you've started to shape it.
Yeah.
That's what I think needs to be done with a bit more open source software. Targets that I would nominate would be GNOME. Seriously, needs you know, some rethinking.
Yeah.
And the whole sound situation on Linux, that, you know, put it in the bin.
Yeah, I'm not even going to start about that one. But Microsoft has an advantage in that they have this whole this framework in place where you can send data and usage statistics to Microsoft, and that's really been something that really helped them, because you can see it in Windows 7 that, you know, they showed us the data, and then you can really see that they've used that data to improve the taskbar. Like, you can see there's an article somewhere, I believe on a Microsoft website or a Microsoft blog, where they detail the various iterations between the original taskbar, which is used in XP and Vista, and the actual end product. And they have all sorts of things that they tried based on the data that they had. It's really, really intriguing. It really shows that they've, you know, the whole new taskbar, and the same thing for the ribbon. Like you said, they didn't pull those out of their behind. So really, you know, they sat down, gathered a whole load of data, and said, well, look, this is how our users use our stuff, and we have to define a certain group, make that definition as wide as possible so that we can include as many users as possible, like 90 or 95%, which is a good figure, and then design it for that 90, 95%, and then include options to make it better for the remaining 10 to 5%. That's how you should try to design. And for Microsoft, it's really difficult, because I think if you look at their operating system, has to actually serve the biggest diversity of people compared to a bigger diversity of people.
You know, 1% is 4 million people.
Yeah, that's the ridiculousness of it. I mean, Apple can get away with making certain decisions because they have to take a smaller group of people into account, and the same thing goes for the open source guys. And then Microsoft has this tremendous group of people to take into account, and then still being able to pull off something like the Ribbon or something like Windows 7. I think that really shows that, you know, as evil as the company obviously is, because every company is evil if you're a consumer, it's still pretty impressive, I think, what they've been able to pull off in the past couple of years. They still have their shenanigans, and they still have their weird things with advertising and you know, calling Linux weird names and making fun of Apple and everything. But you know, right now, when you look at the software offerings, both Office 2007 and Windows 7, I think that's, you know, a pretty solid piece of work to deliver, especially taking into account the amount of people that they actually have to take into account. I think that's pretty impressive. And that's something that the open source guys will have to do as well. They really have to take a closer look at their users, their customers, basically, or even though they don't like it when you call them customers, but they essentially are. They really have to start looking at them, especially when you look at the desktop side of things, like the guys from Genome and KDE. You really have to look at how their users use their software instead of how they think their users should use their software. I think that's pretty critical.
Okay, we're going to need to leave it at that, unfortunately. We've got to finish polishing this turd and get it out to the readers.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's how do we finish this off? I mean, first of all, let's say thank you for listening. If you've got any feedback about the podcast, what we've discussed here, or if there's anything you can contribute to the podcast, you know, an email or send us a recording, we might be able to play on the show. Please send it our way at osnews-crew@osnews.com or in the comments for the podcast article once it's up.
Yep,
I think the other thing I wanted to add was you can follow us on our Twitter accounts, although what we say on our Twitter doesn't necessarily represent the views and opinions of OS News.
It doesn't. Trust me, it doesn't.
Yes, watch out what you're getting. Yeah. I'm at twitter.com/croc, that's K-R-O-C, and you are?
/, and then just Tom Howarda put together, so you can see the name on any of our websites on OS News, so that wouldn't be a problem. That's it, basically.
And with that, I think it's time to say goodbye.
Yeah, so, well,
that's
goodbye.
Croc came in, Croc came in signing off.
And this is Tom Howarda signing off, and we'll see you all next time.